but
true.
I was in South Kensington earlier on. I'm absolutely convinced that I saw Ringo Starr coming out of a shop and walking down the road.
He's around there.
He is, isn't he? Mm. I think it was. I've decided I saw Ringo Starr today, looking fit and well. I'm 70 blah, and I didn't give him a thumbs up. I should have done in the peace sign, peace and love.
Double thumbs up.
Double thumbs. That's for Macca.
All right.
Peace sign for Ringo.
Website of Macca going. It's that hundreds of pictures of him going. Really, people are so.
I saw Ringo Starr on the King's Road once with Barbara Bach. So are they still together?
Yes,
yeah, they are. Absolutely are. Amazing.
Yeah, this was a long time ago, but.
Sort of inertia or something. I don't know what's keeping them together.
They were both, they both filmed little pieces to camera for that Nation's Favourite Beatles song thing that was on a few weeks ago. And Ringo's looking pretty good, you know, he's looking pretty fit.
I think it's probably because nobody loves him better.
Oh, Jesus.
Noises off.
You really have got to be a certain age to get that. 70s Spy Who Loved Me fans.
Hello and welcome to Backlisted. I'm John Mitchinson and we're coming to you live from the kitchen table of Unbound, the website where readers and writers meet to create great books.
Hello everyone, my name's Andy Miller, I'm the author of The Year of Reading Dangerously. John and I are the Leavis and Butthead of, of the book world. I have to tell you, John, I've had a complaint about that joke this week.
What was the complaint?
It's not funny.
Well, that's...
But I've said in the Stuart Lee manner we will continue selling it week after week until it becomes funny.
Well, it's only remotely funny if A, you know who Beavis and Butthead are, and B, if you know who F.R. Leavis is.
I'm confident.
Which I suppose a tiny...
I'm confident that everyone listening to this is familiar with at least one of those.
Right, why don't we start with you this week, Andy? Andy, what have you been reading?
Thanks, John. I've been reading the book Finnegan's Wake by James Joyce. As you do, or as you don't.
It's almost like I can hear little kind of inverted commas in your voice around the word reading.
I have been reading. I read 20 pages of it every morning when I get up. And
sort of calisthenics for the brain.
Yes, scourer for the brain. I've read everything else pretty much written by James Joyce, and I really liked the idea of working my way through a book that is widely held to be never read. I know two people who've read it, and I very much like the idea of being the third person I know who's read it all the way through. So I'm 428 pages into it, and I've got 200 pages to go. Who's counting? I'll be reading it on Christmas morning. So happy Christmas, everyone. When we were talking to Linda, last podcast we did, I was saying, oh, the thing about reading Finnegan's Wake, it's a bit like a prog rock solo. It's like this endless widdly-widdly-wee thing that goes on forever and ever and ever and ever. But it's not. I've revised my opinion. It's more like reading Trout Mask Replica by Captain Beefheart. And like Trout Mask Replica, it's like being... the reader is like a member of the Magic Band. Do you know how Captain Beefheart recorded Trout Mask Replica?
I don't.
OK, well, he basically kept the Magic Band hostage in a house for 6 months. He made them all sleep in one room. And every morning, he would get Zoot Horn Rollo, and he would say to him, I've got a new song. And he'd bang out this atonal thing on the piano, and then Zoot Horn Rollo would have to go next door to where the band was sleeping, eating only rice, and have to learn these incredibly strange and intricate and elusive songs in multiple time signatures. And when I started reading Finnegan's Wake, I felt a bit like, oh, how am I ever going to get my head around this? It's like listening to some very strange piece of music. But as I've got more into it, I think like that Beefheart-like Stockholm syndrome has set in. I'm not enjoying it. I'm actually beginning to really enjoy it. And I've just gone back and reread the first few pages, which seemed like gobbledygook to me the first time I read them. And now they're really beginning to make sense. There's something really wonderful about it. We've actually got a clip, I think, of Joyce reading a page of Finnegan's Wake. So we're just going to listen to that now.
Don't you ken it, or haven't I told you? Every telling has a tailing, and that's the he and the she of it. Look, look, the dusk is growing. My branches lofty are taking root, and my cold chair's gone ashly. Feel ooh, feel ooh. What age is that? It soon is late. 'Tis endless now since I ere one last saw Waterhouse's clock. They took it asunder, I heard them sigh. When will they reassemble it? Oh, my back, my back, my back. I'd want to go to Aixley Pains. Ping, pang, there's the bell for sexolitis. A concepta they send the spray. Pang. Ring out the clothes, ring in the dew. God of Ari, vert the showers and grant thy grace. Amen. Will we spread them here now? Aye, we will. Flip, spread on your bank, and I'll spread mine on mine.
So that's Joyce reading from Finnegan's Wake. And I actually, when I got to that chapter, I read that along with Jim. And I really wish that he'd, I really wish he'd found the time, having spent 17 years writing it, that he'd found the time to read the whole thing. Because actually, when you listen to him read it and you read along with it, you realise how many of the references are meant to be heard rather than read, and how musical it is as well.
Anthony Burgess, who loved it, thought it was a comic masterpiece, said it was a book where you could laugh out loud on almost every page. Is that something you found? You
laugh. There's a quote.
I have to say, full disclosure, I have looked at Finnegan's Wake many times. I have read bits of it.
Yeah.
And I was a huge, huge Joyce fan, and I've read Ulysses more than once, but I just, it is, T.S. Eliot famously called it the great dead end of literature.
And Nabokov called it a snore in the next room.
But do you feel it's improving your sense of something, your sense of perception of? I mean, it's like you say, it's a riff, isn't it? It's a sort of endless.
I really like the idea of someone who's basically faced down any accusations of self-indulgence and gone, well, I'm just going to ignore any of that. I'm just going to do what I want. It's the most determined attempt to write only about what James Joyce wanted to write about in the way James Joyce wanted to write about it.
Can I ask, so last podcast you read Stephen Hawking's Brief History of Time, which is another book that famously nobody's ever read, and you found a factual inaccuracy couple of pages.
I did.
Have you found any factual inaccuracies so far in Finnegan's Wake?
I'll be honest with you, Matt, it's hard to tell. I've also got a reader's guide to Finnegan's Wake, which requires its own reader's guide.
I have that as well, and that was the thing that put me off. But I love this, that Beckett said this. Beckett wrote a long and very good thing about it. You know, what was it called? Our factification around his incarnation of work in progress. But Beckett, I like this. Basically, Beckett seems to suggest that it's an object you should have on your mantelpiece. He said, you cannot complain that this stuff is not written in English. It's not written at all. It's not to be read. It is to be looked at and listened to. His writing is not about something. It is that something itself.
The thing is, that's actually perfectly true. I must say, I'm really finding the experience of reading it really worthwhile and really valuable. Because, you know, I feel confident talking about it before I finish reading it, because it's not like something's going to happen at the end that's going to radically alter my view of it. It's like being immersed, an appropriate, you know, watery image for the Wake, but it's like being immersed in this stream of language. It's terrific. I must just add one final thing about it. There's a Burgess quote on the back of my copy, which says, this is the most entertaining book ever written. Right? Okay. I just have a vision of somebody, they're going on holiday, they've got £10 in their pocket, they go into the bookshop, they go, I want something fun, oh, this is good, this is £8.99, and it's the most entertaining book ever written. I just imagine the lawyer's letters flying to Anthony Burgess. But what have you been reading, John?
Well, it's this time of year, and I have to say this is December 2015, and I always try and read a bit of Dickens that I haven't read before. So I was reading some of his minor Christmas works. A couple of them really I enjoyed hugely. One was called
Minor Christmas Works.
Well, Not a Christmas Carol, which I have to say, okay. I confess utterly, I totally love Christmas Carol, and it's a book that totally transformed, I mean, invented Christmas. The whole thing about Dickens inventing Christmas, which we could go on and on about. But I quite like the whole idea that he had it was delivered to him, downloaded to him, and he wandered around when all sober folks had gone to bed and broke out, as he described himself, like a madman, and sort of wrote it in a very, very quickly. And he'd written it basically to make money, which it didn't at first and then did. But I just liked the idea that it kicked off this mad idea, which was that he would go and read. So when he performed it for the first time, it was a 3-hour performance in Birmingham, of all places. and he was a crowd of 2,000 people. Mm. And he would stand up there, and that was the first time really anybody had done a major public reading. And kind of, you know, he performed all the exciting bits. But what I particularly liked, on his reading days, Dickens would drink 2 tablespoons of rum mixed with cream for breakfast, a pint of champagne for tea, and half an hour before he went on stage would knock back a sherry with a raw egg beaten into it. During the 5-minute interval, he liked a cup of beef tea, and later on headed to Bolt with a bowl of soup. He liked to perform in full evening dress with a bright red flower in his buttonhole, purple waistcoat and watch chain, and he had a team of 6 people. I mean, it was serious going on tour, and he made an absolute fortune. Yeah.
I read Claire Tomlin's biography of Dickens, which was published 2 or 3 years ago, and it's remarkable when you read that, when you see how many things he did. He's writing, he's campaigning, he's drinking champagne for breakfast, he's encouraging his friends to visit him in Broadstairs. It's amazing he didn't die at the age of 25.
And he was massively influential. One of the ones I read, that it's called The Holly Tree, and like Christmas Carol is 4 staves, this is 3 branches. And it starts with a most brilliant description, one of the best descriptions of getting up early in the morning in the freezing cold and getting on a coach and coming out of London. And it basically, what happens is he's leaving London because he thinks he's discovered that his girlfriend actually prefers his best friend to him, and he goes up north and gets snowed in an inn called the Holly Tree, and then actually discovers while he's there that in fact there was a huge misunderstanding, and the girl actually loved him. After all, he goes back and marries her and they have kids and live happily ever after. So it's one of those wonderful, you know, Dickens doing. But what I love, the power of Dickens, is he read this for the first time in the States as a live reading. It was published in 1855. And it was so impressed the people of Boston that one of the publishers in Boston's wife decided to set up a series of not-for-profit restaurants called Holly Tree Inns, which became hugely successful. I mean, it's just one reading of Dickens, and suddenly, you know, there's a whole entrepreneurial chain. And apparently Holly Tree Inns were known well into the 20th century as a place where poor people could go. So that's one. And there was another lovely monologue, which Mrs. Lirriper's Lodgings, which is one of those great Dickensian landladies.
Yeah, I remember.
Hesperus published a lovely edition of it recently with introduction by Philip Hensher. It may become more germane as we come to talk about David Nobbs. There is that thing of transformation in Dickens. You take a character and you either it's the supernatural or it's extremes of weather or it's some, they meet elements of their past, and it's those, once those things are revealed to them, it creates a new possibility for the future. And I think that's sort of maybe a tenuous link. Open up the meat of our discussion.
I just want to say I have read those 2 stories, but this is a moot point to which I suspect we will return frequently in the weeks ahead. I think I've read all of Dickens, but I haven't read
a chunk
of it. Not the letter. All right, all the journalism. Fiction. Okay. I think I've read. Let me modify my brag.
I only ask that because I tell you one of the things that Michael Holroyd once told me, which he said he discovered that Bernard Shaw, of which he was writing the great, magnificent biography, he said that because Shaw had a secretary, he figured out that Shaw could write more words in a day than he, Michael Holroyd, could read in a day. He said, and that's a really terrifying statistic for a biographer to have to juggle with.
But I, just as someone who has read all the fiction of Dickens, all of Dickens, fiction, didn't let me finish.
Okay.
But I read it when I was 20. I'm 47. I can't remember it. I think I read Martin Chuzzlewit. I've read Martin Chuzzlewit. I can't tell you anything about it.
I know. It's like the old Woody Allen line, you know. I took a speed reading course. I've just finished War and Peace. It's about Russia. I think of Pickwick Papers, which I remember loving. I'd say it's about drinking brandy, buttered rum in inns in early Victorian England. I can't really remember.
And yet the feel of a book really stays with you, I think. Yeah. So that if you go back and read that now, you read Pickwick Papers now, the thing that would come back to you, I think, is the feeling of it rather than the specifics of it.
All I will say is I have gone back several times to read Great Expectations. Is my favourite novel, and every time I read it, you should never read those things when you're in your teens, particularly Great Expectations. It's much more interesting reading it in your 50s.
You know what? The thing is, I've come to the conclusion in the last few years that there's not really any point reading anything before you're 40. Because first of all, you're not really going to understand it because you haven't lived enough. right? And the second thing is, if you read it when you're 20, you're going to have forgotten it by now anyway.
Yeah.
So you should just live just, a bit.
Exactly.
Live a bit.
Have a bit of experience. I know.
Exactly.
That's the sound of a man puffing on a pipe for everybody.
That was very good. That was very good.
But I just cry all the time. That's the thing I find. I cry at almost anything now. You know.
Yes. You go easily.
Yeah. Very.
Do you go in either of these stories?
No, not in these. But I did. I cried. I had a little bit of a tear at the end of the Knobs.
I cried during the Knobs.
Yeah.
That seems like the weeping men. We'll now hand over to
the hard man co.
We're delighted to be joined by the novelist Jonathan Coe. Hello, Jonathan.
Hello there.
Jonathan is the author, of course, of Was Carve Up, The Rotters Club, House of Sleep, and many more.
Others too numerous to mention. the phrase you're reaching for, I think.
And also the biographer, of course, of B.S. Johnson, wonderful book, Like a Fiery Elephant.
Brilliant.
And you've just published a new novel called Number 11, which is your 11th novel.
Sort of. I mean, that's why I called it Number 11. But then I did realise afterwards that that I wrote a little children's book, which has not been published in the UK. It's only published in French and Italian.
Wow.
So actually, it's kind of my 12th book. But,
Sound
of a publisher's ears pricking up. Not published
yes,
here, you say?
Indeed.
We'll pick this up again after some marvellously witty and interesting adverts.
We're here to talk about a great favourite of mine and yours, the author David Nobbs, who sadly passed away earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that in the finished copies of Number 11, that the book is dedicated to David, which I thought was a lovely thing. Say a bit about that.
Dedicated to his memory, yes. Yeah, David, as you said, died in August this year, and the first inkling I had of his death, actually, because we'd been in touch fairly regularly, but not for the last few months. First inkling I had was a tweet from you, because I was on a coach in France, looking at my Twitter feed, and you'd quoted a passage from his last book, The Second Life of Sally Mottram.
Yeah,
and I thought, oh, that's nice. And he's quoting bits of David Nobbs. And I scrolled down a bit and I saw other people were talking about David Nobbs as well. And I got that sinking feeling that there's only one reason why suddenly everybody's talking about the same person. Something must have happened to him. So
cover your ears, everyone. I think my actual tweet expressing a great truth was, fucking hell, David Nobbs has died. But yes.
And, you know, I'd known him since the mid-90s, late 90s, something like that probably. And we'd become quite good friends, and one of the things we got into the habit of was sending each other's books, usually shortly before they were about to be published, kind of publishers' advance copies. And we would comment on each other's latest books and this kind of thing. And I realised that I was really going to miss many things about him, but that dialogue in particular, really. And I think David was a very tactful person, but also a very honest person, and you knew from his emails whether he actually liked the book you'd sent him or not. I think of The Close Circle, he said, "Thank you, Jonathan. I did enjoy this book, even though as a writer you did everything you could to stop me enjoying it."
He sent me a lovely note before The Year of Reading Dangerously was published. We sent him a copy, and he very kindly read it and sent me a lovely note, which I choose to believe he liked. He said, you know, "I found the book funny and I found it provocative and all those things." But he said a lovely thing at the end, which is, he said, "I just wanted to send you this note and say thank you for the pleasure that you've given me." And I thought that was a very David-ish thing to do, to specifically thank someone for having entertain them and made them laugh.
Well, pleasure and entertainment were a very important component of literature, as far as David was concerned. I mean, he spent most of his life entertaining people in one way or another, both on television and radio and in his novels. So he felt that very, very keenly himself. Really, it's one of the first things he looked for in a book as a reader was pleasure.
I'm just going to, for the benefit of people listening who aren't familiar with David, I'm just going to give a very short potted biography. David was born in 1935 in Petswood, educated at Marlborough and Cambridge, then became a reporter for the Sheffield Star, which I think he used later in
Pratt of the Argus.
Pratt of the Argus, indeed, yeah. And then in the early 60s, he became a contributor to That Was the Week That Was. And that was his kind of entree into the world of sketch writing. He wrote for Frost, and then he wrote for Kenneth Williams, Frankie Howard, Les Dawson, and the Two Ronnies. You would be familiar with a couple of the sketches, because they're very, very famous, that he wrote for the Two Ronnies, such as the...
Just the Complete Rook.
The Complete Rook.
The restaurant which only has rook-related...
Yeah.
He didn't.
And the mispronounced worms.
Yes.
That was him as well.
He didn't do the Mastermind one with the...
No, that's David Renick.
Renick, that's right. And his co-writer for some of this was Barry Cryer, that's right, isn't it? And
he wrote with Barry Cryer, yep.
I want to talk specifically about David as a novelist as we go on, but he was also writing novels. He wrote 20 novels in total. The first published in 1965, the last published in 2014. His most famous book is probably The Death of Reginald Perrin, subsequently adapted for television as The Rise and Fall of Reginald Perrin.
Fallen Rise.
Oh,
God. Textbook, Andy.
Oh, I've let myself down.
You see what he was doing there, though?
Yes. And he also wrote radio plays, radio series... He adapted your novel, What a Carve-Up.
For the radio, he did, for Radio 4. A great eight-part adaptation on Radio 4.
And he wrote a memoir called I Didn't Get Where I Am Today. Of course I didn't get where I am today. But he was also a humanist. He was a long-standing patron of the British Humanist Association. And that's really the book that you suggested that we all read prior to talking about this is a novel that he published in 2011 when he was 75, called It Had to Be You.
Yeah, he had an amazing kind of flowering as a novelist, really, in his 70s. I think he published 6 or 7 novels in his 70s. And particularly the last 4, actually, just sort of poured out of him almost at yearly intervals. And they're pretty long, substantial pieces of work. You can also sense a kind of deepening and an increasing richness and seriousness in his writing. Actually, I mean, the books are still funny, but they aren't as funny as the Reginald Perrin or Henry Pratt novels. I don't see that as a criticism, but I think David was changing and evolving as a writer. And in fact, many years ago, when I reviewed him for the Sunday Times, I made this very bold statement, which the then literary editor of the Sunday Times actually phoned me up and invited me to withdraw from the end of the review. I said that David Thomas was probably our finest post-war comic novelist. The word "probably," of course, is the huge is the huge let-out clause there. And this was duly plonked on the front cover of every book he published since, I think, until. Including It Had to Be You, but towards the end, David asked for it to be taken off, and he said, you know, it's nothing personal, Jonathan, but I don't want to be regarded as a comic novelist anymore. That's not how I think of myself.
I just want
to be thought of as a novelist. And he felt the term was a bit diminishing, really. And with It Had to Be You, I think you can see where he's coming from, because it's a very, very serious novel.
I'm just going to read this is going to become a backlisted tradition, and we're going to read the blurb on the back of each book. So no spoilers for those of you who haven't read it.
And that's good. It's not because we haven't read it.
No, we've all read it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, yeah.
Summer is in full swing, and it is one of those heady Wimbledon summers. That strawberries and champers couldn't be further from James Hollinghurst's mind, because his life is about to be turned upside down. Running a dwindling business and acting as patriarch of a dysfunctional family is stressful enough, but when tragedy strikes, it is only the start of James' myriad problems. Myriad, that's very good. His daughter Charlotte won't speak to him, an old flame has reared her head, and he just has to do something about his PA Marcia. And then, of course, there's Helen. .. It Had to Be You is a comic and dark portrait of a good man who has done bad things and is about to realise that even death can't conceal the most hidden of truths. John, do you want to say...
This is my first... I was a knobs virgin until this, and I have to say I really, really enjoyed this book and actually will definitely go and read more of his work. Comic is such a difficult word, isn't it? Because if you're talking about Shakespeare's comedies and Shakespeare's tragedies, it means one thing. But if you're talking about writing knob gags for television, it means something quite different. This is a proper grown-up novel about serious things. It starts with, I think we're allowed to say, there's no point really trying to hide the plot too much, but it starts with the protagonist's wife being killed in a head-on accident. And it's about dealing with, as much as anything else, the practical What I love about it is the practical details of how you deal with some major tragedy and how you mentally... The book, it really is about him coming to terms with the loss of a life, a wife who he is being has been for 5 years previously unfaithful to. I don't think I've read anything that's been quite as convincing. And by the end, really deeply moving about that process of grief. But beyond that, the thing that I sort of really realised that other than Jonathan's own work, lower middle class, sort of suburbia, you realise how little of it there is in English fiction and how peculiar that is. I mean, I guess, you know, there's quite a lot of chick lit that is set in that milieu, but not a lot of what I would call serious fiction. And I, although it's a comic in the biggest sense of the word...
No, I agree.
It's not... he's not, I would say, it's not comedy. It's not laugh out loud.
There are plenty of novels set in the inner city, and there are plenty of novels set in Hampstead, but there are precious few set in Surbiton.
Yeah.
You know,
or Purley,
where most people live.
What is it about the world of packaging that makes it so ripe for the office and this? Both
that's
like.
True. It's very true.
Oh, it's that great scene where he gives the speech towards the end, where the business is, you know, he's having to stand in front of the, and he's kind of addled by grief at this point, and he has to stand up in front of her, and he gives this fantastic speech. And what's the line where he's sort of saying, you know, I work in the world of packaging, and then it was said, do you fancy a fuck? I think it's what's going through his head.
Exactly, yeah.
Response, and I think the one that he put, he doesn't actually say that in the speech in front of his boss. He actually says, you know, what are you doing next Thursday?
Yeah,
it's got all of that glob pack, which is the name of the company. It still has that lovely Reggie Perrin, and I'm speaking as somebody who hasn't read the novels, only seen the television twice, so I know one of the things that you will come up is that the Reggie Perrin novels are actually a lot darker than they appeared in television. But I felt he was brilliant. I mean, I thought the way it was structured was really well. There was maybe one plot line too many. I'm not sure we needed the murder.
Careful, spoilers.
Okay, I'm not going to tell you anymore.
Jonathan, did you have a bit that you wanted to read?
Yeah, I was just going to read a little bit of dialogue between the hero, or the anti-hero, whatever you want to call him, James Hollinghurst, and the vicar who has come round to discuss the funeral arrangements.
Vicar.
And
top
I,
vicar.
Yes. And, I do agree with you about the how rare it is to see... You know, these kind of scenes in modern fiction, really. And to me, that's about David's warmth as a writer and his willingness to find kind of drama and greatness in these banal settings. I mean, as the guy making the speech about packaging says, you know, somebody has to package things. We're actually doing something incredibly important here. And at the same time, you know, these people are full of kind of grandiose hopes and dreams just like everybody else. So it's the disjunction between those. Yeah.
Isn't it? It's a great theme in David's work, I think.
Yes, absolutely. So this is the dialogue between James and the Reverend Martin Vigar. The Reverend Martin Vigar had sparse hair, which he'd carefully combed to cover as much of his pate as possible. He was very tall and walked with the slight stoop of a man who doesn't want to intimidate his fellow mortals. James couldn't believe that he was so pleased to welcome a vicar to his home. Then anything that took his mind off the evening to come was welcome. In fact, the vicar fascinated him. When, on being offered a cup of tea, he replied, "That would be quite delightful. The cup that cheers." And, no sugar, thank you. I'm sweet enough already. He was every inch a vicar and as arch as a bishop. But when they went into the living room and he got a wad of A4 and a ballpoint pen out of his briefcase, his voice lost its trace of sing-song and developed a hint of North Kent, and his businesslike manner led James to expect that at any moment he would say, "Now, life insurance, are you adequately covered?" This prompted him to say, "Quite a change of career you've had," to which the vicar replied with a smile, "Yes, straight from mammon to God. Did you get a sudden call, as it were?" The Reverend Martin Vigar gave a self-deprecating smile. "Nothing as dramatic as a call," he said, "more of a whisper in my ear. I suppose increasingly over the years I began to feel the need for a meaning to life, and particularly to my life." "And have you found that meaning?" The vicar hesitated. "It isn't as clear-cut as that," he said. "I am finding it. It's a process, a long process, not always an easy process." He turned suddenly grave. "I'm so sorry that my first visit to your lovely home should be for such a sad reason. Thank you." He produced a sheet of paper and handed it to James, and again it felt as though it would be a quote for insurance. "The order of service. I think it's as agreed, but I thought we should check before it..." This is in inverted commas. "Goes to print." James looked through it carefully. "Yes, that's fine." I had a very good talk with your brother Philip. He seemed a very nice man. He's great. That's so good to hear in this time of crisis for the family. James was beginning to realise that there were a lot of inverted commas in the vicar's life. He emphasised that you are not, in essence, a religious family. James was careful not to fall into his catchphrase, not to say, I'm sorry. He felt very strongly that this was nothing to apologise for. No, we're not. In fact, I'll be honest with you. After we'd arranged all the details, I wondered if we should have gone for a humanist service. Ah, yes, the woodland burial route. Well, let me reassure you, Mr. Hollinghurst, this will be a Christian funeral service, but it will not be pious. It will be, if I may put it like that, soft on God. Very low church, very C of E, you might say. In my eulogy, I will touch upon the message of eternal life, but I won't, quote, rub it in. Thank you. Then James found himself approaching three words that he would find difficult to utter with a straight face. More tea, Vicar?
That's so good, isn't it?
It's genius.
So good. It's so great that you picked that section, the humanist section, because Matt and I were talking earlier about this book. Matt had read it, and he said Matt was saying it had turned out differently. The plot had turned out differently from how he was expecting. I don't want to give the ending away, but there aren't any more deaths before the end of the book.
Yeah.
And there is an implication that perhaps we might expect one or two more before the end of the book.
Mm.
And I felt that knowing something of David's humanist beliefs, that what happens to James is really what David wanted to write about. That he has a journey from, I suppose, kind of some kind of queasy agnosticism to a sort of convinced humanism. And I found this quote from David, which he gave around the time this book was published. He said, "I believe there are just as many Christian virtues to be found among the faithless as the faithful. Furthermore, these qualities are explored and developed along individual paths. We have no God whom we can burden with the responsibilities of our actions. Loss of faith. It sounds so negative. I didn't lose faith. I gained faith. Faith in people." And I think that's... David's clearly writing in this novel... I don't know, it's totally autobiographical, but there is a similar path of enlightenment expressed, as you say, in a packaging firm, around a suburban funeral in the space of a week.
Mm. I think it is a highly autobiographical book, actually. And we can talk about this because he comes clean about it in his own autobiography that towards the end of his first marriage, he was unfaithful to his first wife, and he felt terrible guilt about this. And I think he chose a really interesting way in this book to write about grief, in the character of a man whose wife dies a sudden death, and his initial feeling is relief and freedom, a kind of horrible guilt-ridden sense of relief that he can go straight to his mistress and say, "Great, we can now spend the rest of our lives together." And readers who are looking for that easy kind of likable central character to identify with and root for from the beginning of the novel are in trouble with this book because James is quite dislikable at some points and kind of hypocritical. But David, as you say, traces a very beautiful trajectory for him, I think, from that sense of complicated, guilt-ridden, hypocritical fucked upness at the beginning of the beginning of the book, and heavy drinking. Actually, it's a lot of alcohol really consumed drinking. In this.
Well, the screaming at the radio is a thing. As
yes,
well.
I wondered if that. What if you could do the drink along with this book, and how quite smashed you'd be at the end of it.
Charles Dickens could, but I'm not sure the rest of us could.
And the screaming at the radio bit was, who hasn't sat in their car and berated the radio for using the wrong word, and it's just.
Yes.
I also like his toast routines in the morning. Remember,
one of David's great skills as any kind of writer, TV writer, novelist, is he's brilliant on comedy of repetition.
Yeah. Mm.
And there's a motif in this, again, there's a motif about toast in this book, which sounds very unpromising as I say it, which is cumulatively brilliant as the book goes on.
Yeah, and he's very good at lists. I was just thinking about the vicar, because the vicar, I think I'm allowed, not giving too much away to say, the vicar, having promised that he is, so low church, and the vicar turns out to be a dreadful ham.
That's
funeral.
Right.
I just want to read this little bit. This is brilliant paragraph, I think, wonderfully written. A humorous note crept into the vicar's voice. like a mouse into a platter of cheeses, as he related a vaguely amusing anecdote with which James had primed him. "No," James wanted to cry. "Don't signal the joke. You'll kill it, frail thing that it is." He closed his ears to it. He couldn't bear to hear it, but he did hear the faint flitter of laughter that passed through the congregation like a breeze through a spinny.
Breeze through a spinny, yes, I spotted that. It's wonderful.
And that is just absolutely... And then he says, rapidly stifled as the Reverend Martin Vigar slipped back into evangelism. But yeah, it's he. I mean, I think that's one of the things that's so joyful about the book is that, you know, there are these... without drawing attention to his style at all, he's both very funny, but at the end, there's a fantastic kind of piece at the end where he's standing in the garden. And incredibly moving and incredibly true and right, I think.
Jonathan was referring to the fact that David wrote how many novels in his last 10 years? Seven,
I think, yeah.
In those novels, he was quite pleased with doing something different every time that he hadn't done before. So he published a novel in 2008 called Cupid's Dart, which is the first novel that he'd written in the first person. He wrote Obstacles to Young Love in 2010. That's the first he'd written in the present tense. Mm. It Had to Be You is the first that he'd written that took place over a short period of time. That he likes to set himself slightly new frameworks to... so as not to get bored and not to bore the reader.
Yeah.
You know. I wonder if we could go back and talk a little bit about Reginald Perrin. Reginald Perrin is the first of David's books that I read. I think it's the first you read, isn't it, Jonathan?
First that everybody reads, I think, a lot of the time. I don't know how it was for you, but the TV series came on air in 1976, and after two or three episodes, I just went straight out to W.H. Smith, as it was then, in my local town, and bought the Penguin Tyne TV version, and immediately noticed how different it was from the television series. I mean, the first half of the book follows the same narrative contours, but the tone is darker, and towards the end, it gets more surreal. And, you know, Ridge's desperation is more intense and uncomfortable and less comic than it was.
It's the story of a man having a nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
Midlife crisis turning into a nervous breakdown, right? Mm. And it's very funny. But I think one of the things that was very clear when David died was that the success of his television work had detracted somewhat from his reputation as a novelist.
Mm.
Plus, I think a general... unease in Britain, particularly with the idea that things can be both funny and serious at the same time. And for me, you know, in my own work, and Jonathan, I think in your books as well, one of the things I got from David when I read Reginald Perrin and his subsequent books is the ease with which he mixes comedy and all other things.
Yeah.
As though, because that's what life is like. Life isn't. It doesn't not have comedy in it.
Well, there's a lovely part somewhere in the book, in It Had to Be You, where he talks about the desire, wishing there was more gentleness in TV drama. Mm. And I always thought that one of the great things about Reggie Perrin, and I'm sort of interested to know a little bit about that, because I haven't read the books. I've heard people say, for example, that Martin Clunes actually is a more believable Reggie Perrin than Leonard Rossiter, although that's really difficult if you've got the Leonard Rossiter performance in your head to ever kind of separate it, because he was a great comic actor. But that idea of a man, you know, having a nervous breakdown, sort of darker side to it, that Clunes gets that better. But I wondered, do the catchphrases, they can't be obviously as sort of metronomic in the book as they are
They're almost as metronomic, I think.
Because they are in life, aren't they?
Yes.
They are in life. That's how people talk.
Well, I didn't get where I am today, Andy. Right?
Super.
Yeah. I'm just not a podcast kind of person.
I'm just not a catchphrase person. Yeah, and so on.
I think Leonard Rossiter was brilliant as Reggie, actually, but I do wonder what it would have been like with Ronnie Barker, which was David's first choice of casting. He was tied up with Porridge during those years and couldn't take on another major sitcom. So,
but it's interesting why I don't really feel we produce sitcoms that have got that broad. Massive popular appeal at the Porridges and the Reggie Perrins.
Jonathan, was David bothered by his diminished reputation as a novelist?
No, not at all. I mean, I think he may have made life easier for him in his negotiations with publishers and so on if he'd, you know, on a purely practical basis, if his reputation, if he'd had a rock-solid reputation as a novelist. But he was very, very grateful for his fame as a TV writer, very, very proud, not just of the Reggie Perrin series, but a bit of a do as well. Yeah. And just, you know, the sketches he wrote, he genuinely saw no division between high and low culture, I don't think, and was just as happy, pleased with himself at the end of a working morning if he'd produced a beautiful paragraph like the one that John read out, or if he'd, you know, produced a really good knob gag for Les Dawson.
Yeah, but I think his readers really appreciate that. People I've known over the years who love David's work feel they were getting something from David in terms of both entertainment and being thought-provoking that they don't get from many other writers. And for me, that's the great strength in his novel writing, plus the fact he never stands still. We've got a clip of David talking about one of his later novels and the dilemma of titling novels. If we could listen to that would be great.
Hello again. Exciting news. Next week I'm starting on writing my 19th novel, The Coppinger Scandal. Well, I say the Coppinger scandal, but my lovely publishers, Harper, do have a habit of changing the titles of my books. It'll probably end up being called something like Sex on the Kitchen Table. Actually, that's a much better title.
OK, he refers in that clip to a novel called, I think, The Coppinger Affair or...
Coppinger Crisis.
Coppinger Crisis, yeah. And he says, you know, my publishers will have other ideas. And they did.
They did,
when
yes.
When the novel was published, it was published as...
The Fall and Rise of Gordon Coppinger, yeah.
They got it right.
You know. For obvious cash-in reasons, which is... That's not such a big deal in a way, but I do think it's a great shame that they changed the title of It Had to Be You, because it was supposed to be called Life After Deborah. Which to me is a great title and tells you what the book is about.
Well, I don't actually.
And it had to be you.
It had to be you.
Well, you know, I was rereading this book this week and waiting for the moment where the song came in or a phrase came in or something.
I hadn't thought that was perfect. But completely meaningless.
Yeah. This would be an even more memorable book if it had if it had David's title.
In terms of his influence on you, Jonathan, was it as simple as after you'd gone to W.H. Smith, presumably when you were quite young, and read Reggie Perrin, did you think, I want to write books like that? Was it sort of that straightforward a thing?
Well, I was already writing books a bit like that, but then I started to write books that were really like that, I think. I mean, if it's 1976, we're talking about early 1976, I suppose, and I would have been 14. And I think I also read Catch 22 that year. And those two books, in their completely different ways, made me think, not consciously, but on some level, that, okay, so you can be serious and funny at the same time.
Yeah.
This combination is possible. And from that point on, I was trying to find my own way of doing that, which took many, many years. But Reginald Perrin was certainly one of the main things that sent me on that route.
Andy Hamilton, who's another Nobs fan, said exactly that. He said, you know, life, he said, is both funny and serious, and usually at the same time. He said it's only marketing departments that want to separate those two things, and I think that is a problem. I can kind of see why having comic novelist on the front of your book it's a bit like, you know, talking to P.D. James or Ruth Rendell back in the day, and they were all saying, well, we're never going to win the Booker Prize because we write crime novels. And you think, It's sort of a ridiculous distinction, isn't it? If you read either of those two in particular,
and yet at the same time, I mean, David's ability to turn a comic phrase. I'm a big fan of the third Reggie Perrin book, The Better World of Reginald Perrin, which
is not a good television series. I don't think.
It's the one. I'm going to just explain what it is. It's the one where they open a commune. I'm just going to read a little bit from that.
The second one is Grot, right?
Yeah, the second one is Grot,
which is great.
Yeah, but he has a phrase in this book to describe Christmas Day. Christmas Day was grey, still, and silent, as if the weather had gone to spend the holidays with its family. I mean, you know, that's Woodhouse.
That's very nice, yeah.
But there's a little section here. I'm just going to read this very quickly. I remember reading this in, I would estimate, 1980, at the age of 12. And I think I've laughed about it on a weekly basis ever since. So if everyone will indulge me, I'm going to share this with you. Here we go. It's only a paragraph. Guests continued to pour in to Perrin's. which is the name of the commune. Some had strange tales and quirks to relate. There was the hotelier who owned a chain of small hotels and restaurants which bore famous names, but with the first letter missing. He owned the Avoy, Orchester, and It's in London, Affles in Singapore, Axims in Paris, and the Algonquin in New York. The idea was that people would mistake them for their renowned equivalents. What actually happened was that some people said, look, the first letter's dropped off the Dorchester, it must be going downhill. While the others said, oh, look, some silly Burke's trying to pretend that's the Ritz. The final straw to his collapsing empire came when he stayed at the Avoy and found that its first letter had dropped off, so that the neon sign outside the grubby frontage simply read, Voy Hotel. I mean, that's such
a brilliant gag.
He was great with names. I mean, my favourite school bully in all of literature is from Second from Last in Sacrifice. Mm. He's called Tosser Pilkington Brick. And I love both the kind of funniness of it and the lack of imagination, that when the guy at the beginning of It Had to Be You checks into the hotel and has to give a false name, he thinks as quickly as he could and writes Mr. and Mrs. Rivers, Lakeview, 69 Pond Street, Pool.
With desperately serious consequences.
Yes, that's terrific.
And in a very early novel, Ostrich Country, from 1968, he has an estate in a new town named after its most famous resident, Sir Bernard Coulthart, the famous dermatologist, author of Pustules Can Be Fun and many similar works. It was in his honour that all the streets had been named after skin diseases. The spacious cul-de-sac where the larger houses were set in their leafy gardens was known as the Shingles. But Paula's mother lived with her widowed sister in a more modest house, 32 Impetigo Close.
Genius. There is just something. There's a passage. This is him watching television the night he's discovered his wife has died. He switched the television on, flicked through the channels, saw a pathologist cutting out the left eye of a middle-aged man and dropping it into a bottle. A panellist in a panic as he thought of the ridicule he was going to get from his workmates after he'd failed to name the capital of Hungary. A C-list fashion designer eating leeches in a mangrove swamp. An audience roaring as an overpaid chat show host held out a box of chocolates to a pretty actress and said, "Can I give you one?" A pathologist cutting up a pretty girl, a celebrity chef cutting up a bulb of fennel, blood pouring from the stomach of a woman in a crypt, an ugly 22-stone man with a horrendous paunch throwing a dart at a board, a lion eating a cheetah, a pathologist cutting up a gay young man, a manly Rock Hudson trying to seduce a virginal Doris Day, a pathologist cutting up a very obese man, a celebrity chef cutting up a loin of pork, and two sloths copulating, well, slothfully. I mean, it's satire, but he's just got that great, it makes it look very, very easy, which it isn't. Mm.
I thought the Jonathan and I were both involved with an event to commemorate David's life earlier in the year. Jonathan, could you just share the once in a lifetime lineup of writers and artists who were gathered together?
Yeah, it's testament to his how many different worlds he had a foot in, really. There was Patricia Hodge reading from David's books, who played in a couple of his TV series. There was Eleanor Bron, who knew him at Cambridge in the Footlights. David Quantick, the writer of Veep, was there chairing the whole thing. There was me and Andy.
Me clinging onto the side of the stage by my fingernails, to be honest with you.
Have I missed anyone else? Oh, Barry Cryer.
Barry
Cryer. The great Barry Cryer, yeah.
Barry Cryer. Yeah.
So we were tasked with talking about David and reading from his work, and Jonathan and I performed a particular part of Reggie Perrin. And afterwards, Eleanor Bron, who was absolutely wonderful, came up to me and said, "You read that marvellously, darling. I always like to hear how those who aren't in the business approach these things." I took that as a compliment. We'll see.
I'm sure it was.
So this has been great today. I hope this acts as an advert for David's work, really, that he was a wonderful writer and a very, very nice man. And as my tweet suggested, I was genuinely very shocked and saddened when he died earlier this year. And I wonder, Jonathan, could you just... it seems appropriate to read something from the end of It Had to Be You.
Ridiculously titled It Had to Be You.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is from the very closing pages of the book when Deborah's funeral has taken place. All of the various plot strands have been resolved, and James is having a moment of reflection in his back garden. He's had a kind of moment of epiphany at the funeral where he's realised that he doesn't... His kind of half-hearted belief in God has slipped away, and instead he's sitting in his garden contemplating the universe, really. And David writes, he looked up into the... Not the heavens. Heavens, no, into the sky. He was alone, alone with only the whole solar system, the vast galaxies, the unimaginable distances, the inconceivable immensity of it. And here mankind was, on one piddling little planet, and he was of no significance on this planet. He wasn't even important in so-called Great Britain. He was just a speck in the vast, sprawling city of London. He didn't even stand out in Islington. He didn't stand out in his street in Islington, damn it. Until last Wednesday, he hadn't even been the best person living in his house. But he felt excited, challenged by his belief that his life was not serving God's purpose. He felt with a surge of optimism that without belief in a received purpose in life, he had the strength to make his own life purposeful.
Well, thanks very much for listening, everyone. Thanks, Jonathan, for coming in and talking about David. You can find Backlisted on Facebook, and you can find us on Twitter at BacklistedPod. And we're now going to be locked in for the entirety of Christmas while I read Finnegan's Wake to John Mitchinson until both John and I are crying.
On every page, ladies and gentlemen. That's what I've been promised.
So we hope you enjoy Christmas, and we'll see you in the new year.
If you prefer to listen to Backlisted without adverts, you can sign up to our Patreon. It's www.patreon.com/backlisted. As well as getting the show early, you get a whole 2 extra episodes of what we call Locklisted, which is Andy, me and Nikki talking about the books, music and films we've enjoyed in the previous fortnight.